Welcome to Listen In. I'm Brian Gahan, and this podcast focuses on the stories that are buried deep inside all conversations. Be it the kind of conversation you have with someone whose life experience is full of interesting POVs and insights, or the kind of conversation you have inside your own head around your own life experiences. Today, in episode 25, I'm talking with award-winning author and self-publishing entrepreneur, Vince Fond. Vince shares how a fascination with a popular movie of the mid-80s, his love of David Bowie music, and a late-night internet music radio show magically led him to collaborating on his first book with the real-life subject of the movie, and ultimately led him to building a publishing imprint named in honor of Bowie and everything in between. Well, hello, Vince. Welcome to Listen In.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great to talk to you. I want to know your backstory a bit about how you got into self-publishing, but I want to go even further back and just learn your story about how you got into writing and getting to the point where you were then looking to publish.
Sure, yeah. I think it starts with the fact that writing is, I always say this, writing is the only thing that I have ever been able to do with any level of competency. I started writing when I was 9 or 10 years old, you know, just watching Twilight Zone episodes and late night creature features, things like that. Those are the things that really got me, you know, got me fired up and interested in my weird preteen brain that I had. And so therefore, you know, I've got like my biggest hero being Rod Serling, for example.
Right. Tell me that story. How did he become your biggest hero?
I think it was simply by virtue of the fact that I grew up in the early 70s. Where he was, even after his death in 1975, he was a permanent fixture on television. The Twilight Zone was in regular rotation by then, you know, every Monday through Friday at 11:30 at night, following The Odd Couple repeats, would be The Twilight Zone. Mm-hmm. I had parents who were fortunately very permissive. They would let me stay up till midnight to watch The Twilight Zone Monday through Friday, probably because, I don't know, I wasn't a troubled child. It wasn't like I was, you know, threatening to burn down the house if they didn't let me get my way. But I think that they just knew that there was something about it that was feeding me it was somehow feeding me my creativity or maybe my well-being. I don't know.
That's really interesting, because you would think that the nature of that programming, you know, it would keep you up at night or you wouldn't be able to sleep, you know. And so for your parents to see that it was, you know, feeding your creativity, that's pretty intuitive of them.
Yeah. And as a consequence, I didn't, I missed a lot of school as a kid. So everything that and of course, you know, I got better at that, you know, when I became, you know, grew a little older and decided that if you want to make friends, you have to be at school and these kinds of things. I think nowadays about the environments, or that rather, I think nowadays about the different options that children have or families have of homeschooling and things like that. And I think if I had had that option, that might have been ideal for me at the time.
So you had a love for the quirky and the interesting and the creative. And so as a teenager, is that when you started to explore writing? You started to write your own stories like that?
Yeah, the opportunity for that actually arose in sixth grade when I had an awesome teacher, Jerry O'Day, who I'm still friends with nowadays, today, thanks to the magic of the internet and Facebook, who encouraged, she was a former music teacher this was her first year teaching grade school kids, you know, the full day curriculum, sixth grade. And you know, one of the things that she, so as a consequence of coming from a music background, she was very creative and wanted to, you know, inspire kids to be creative. And so she inspired me to write. So I would write in a journal every day that I would turn in, you know, little stories. So she was really my first audience.
Mm-hmm.
And looking back on those, I still have those. Looking back on those, they were horrible. But, you know, you don't tell an 11-year-old kid, you know, to read more or get better. You just want to give them enough fuel
mm-hmm.
that they will do something. And in high school, I signed up for journalism class. I had no idea what that meant, but I knew that I wanted an easy elective.
Yeah, or what you thought would be an easy elective, right?
Right. Something that would, I wasn't into English, you know, I wasn't into reading all the classics. I wanted to read Twilight Zone stories. I wanted to read Stephen King books. I didn't want to read Of Mice and Men, although I did. And it blew my mind, obviously. But, you know, I did what I could to get by. And come high school, I signed up for journalism, which was made me part of the school newspaper. You know, Live Oak High School, Morgan Hill, California, the Oak Leaf newspaper was one of the state's best newspapers for high school newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
And my teacher there, Harvey Wainer, was another person who sort of let me fly my creativity flag. So instead of writing news stories, I would write short stories, and they get published in the school newspaper. And I think it was my sophomore year, I won a writing contest. It was a countywide writing contest, and I won first place. And that night I realized, I said, oh, you know what this means to me. In my 15-year-old mind, I thought, this means that I'm going to be a writer. I'm going to be a successful writer.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Interestingly enough, I love to tell this story because my schoolmate, my classmate, her name was Tammy, who won second place. She's now a published author with Penguin Random House, I believe, one of the big ones. She's a published author with you know, bestsellers.
Right.
And the difference was, and the reason that I'm not, is because as soon as I graduated from high school, I stopped writing.
I interrupted you there. My apologies. But why? Do you know why you stopped?
I think it had something to do with, I took guitar lessons, and that ruined my life for 20 years.
A guy wanting guitar, you know, to be a guitar rock star, that's a very, very normal way for guys to, you know, sometimes go down the wrong road, right?
Right. And I think a part of me thought, you know, if I'm going to get a girl, I'm not going to get it by writing Stephen King short stories. I'm probably going to get a girl because I play guitar and do a little singing. Of course, you know, doing something like that, that's people who do those things for a living or do it very well. I have great respect for them because there's nothing more boring than to practice guitar.
Right.
When you could be watching a movie.
Well, or when you're meant to be a writer of actual, you know, literature as opposed to writer of songs.
Exactly. And it took me a very, very long time to actually get back to writing. And my wife was the person who I credit for writing me and telling me, you really need to write, because that's something that I can see from your past examples that you've shown me. That's something that you really know how to do well. And I mean, at this point, I was in my 30s.
Right.
I had toiled. I worked in a garage changing tires. You know, I had, you know, I'd spent the better part of my 20s kind of lost,
mm-hmm.
reading a lot, listening to a lot of music, wondering what it was that I could be.
Right.
You know, at this point, I was sort of settling in for taking day jobs to pay the bills.
Right.
So that I could do things. I could have things, DVDs, music, books, things like that. And at one point, I started kind of a blog online where I'd write these little stories like, you know, the best album of 2010, you know, that sort of thing, mm-hmm. or the top 10 bands of this year, or the best, you know, the top 5 non-traditional Christmas movies, things, fun things like that.
Right.
And I started writing. Well, what happened was that I was working in a call center of all places, and they opened up a position for a technical writer. And I thought, this is something that I can do. I can do, I'll first of all, get off the phones. Everybody wants to get, when you work in a call center, being on the phone is terrible. But so I wanted to get off the phones and get just a desk job. And I just took to it like a duck to water, I guess. And that sort of started everything. I started writing at work and I started writing at home. I got job opportunities to freelance for what are commonly known as content farms nowadays.
Right.
But, you know, some of the people that I worked for were legitimate companies that were paying well. And at some point in 2010, I quit my day job to do freelancing full time. And that is sort of the leaping off point to how a couple of years later I got into self-publishing.
Yeah. So tell me that story, because I'm very curious to know how you got to the point where you wrote your first book and the content of your first book, the subject matter of it, how all that came into your life, because it's a pretty interesting sort of launching off point, so to speak.
Well, at this point, and the book that you're referring to is called American Sons, The Untold Story of the Falcon and the Snowman, which a lot of people may remember. Anybody over 40 is going to remember it,
mm-hmm.
maybe 50. Anybody under that will not. They'll probably say The Falcon and the Winter Soldier or something like that. But here was a story that I had been fascinated with since I was a teenager, the true story. In 1985, there was a movie made called The Falcon and the Snowman, starring Timothy Hutton and Sean Penn, two of the biggest stars in the world at the time, directed by and written by, you know, these, you know, A-class filmmakers. It was a critically acclaimed movie about a true story about two young men from Southern California in the early 70s who sold satellite secrets to the Soviet Union, got caught, and went to prison.
Welcome back. I'm talking with author and publishing entrepreneur Vince Font about the movie that started it all and the significance David Bowie's music had on his journey.
When I'm 15, I'm in journalism class. I am copy editing. I am typesetting. I'm typing the things that will eventually be put in the paper. And I watch a movie. I'm a David Bowie fan. I watch a movie with two of my favorite actors called The Falcon and the Snowman. My favorite actors are together in a movie with a great David Bowie song. I watched the movie and I became completely fascinated. Where most people sort of dropped off, I started reading. I read the books, the book The Falcon and the Snowman, written by Robert Lindsay, the follow-up book called The Flight of the Falcon. One of the guys broke free from prison and was caught 19 months later. That was fascinating. And it was just a you know, an interest, a lifelong fascination with this story, mm-hmm. that even my wife recalls. She said, you know, one of the first things that you and I talked about when we met was The Falcon and the Snowman. And I said, really? I didn't realize that I was that boring a conversationalist, first of all. And so, you know, then we fast forward to the point where I am now in my 30s and I'm writing professionally. I'm doing freelance writing. I start writing short stories for myself, and I'm looking for a platform. And I did that on Amazon Kindle. I released a short story. Now, at the same time, my wife and I had a podcast. It was an internet radio show.
Right.
Internet music radio show. And one of my favorite soundtracks has always been, as you can imagine, the Falcon and the Snowman soundtrack. Mm-hmm. We had a broadcast in which it was the 25th anniversary. So it was 2010. I decided I wanted to play the entire soundtrack to the movie on our little internet radio show. And about a week later, I got an email. I sometimes got emails from people saying, hey, will you play my music? You know, nice show. I got an email from a lady named Kate Boyce, who said something to the effect of, you know, that's a great soundtrack. It's too bad the movie had such a lousy ending, or something like that. Because one of the points that I always like to make is that I always thought that the Falcon and the Snowman soundtrack was superior to the movie itself. I emailed back and I said, thanks for listening to the show. Are you related to Christopher Boyce? Christopher Boyce being the central character that the Falcon and the Snowman was based on, mm-hmm. who last I heard was in prison serving a 40-year sentence for espionage.
Right.
And she wrote back and she said, I'm his wife. And I immediately Google searched, Wikipedia searched Christopher Boyce and found out that he had been released from prison about almost 10 years before. This was the first time that I was aware that these two young men who went to prison in 1977 had served enough time to be released and they were out. Mm-hmm. And that was fascinating to me. You know, a couple of guys who get sent to federal prison for basically being spies for the KGB, you don't imagine that they're going to get out of prison anytime soon.
Right.
I thought they'd be there forever. And come to find out, they've both been released from prison. And one of this individual that I was speaking with named Kate Boyce, I discovered was a paralegal. She was an advocate for the release of nonviolent criminals, and still is. And she had taken up the case of trying to obtain parole, release from prison for Christopher Boyce and Andrew Dalton Lee, which was the second half of this Falcon and the Snowman team.
He was the Sean Penn.
Exactly, yeah. And the Falcon gets his name because he flew Falcons, and the Snowman gets his name because he was a cokehead and a coke dealer. And these were terms that were made up by the writer Robert Lindsay. They were never really assigned like code names for the KGB, right, to, you know, call them. But in any case, so I got to know this person, Kate Boyce, via email. I said, oh, you know, wow. Please give your husband my regards. You know, I don't want to say I felt like a fanboy or anything like that, because I never was somebody who thought that people who, I never was one who thought that somebody who committed espionage should be set free necessarily. But it was always the story of the way all of this unfolded, and these guys were so young and they made such a drastic mistake. Mm-hmm. It was a tragedy. It wasn't so much a crime thriller as it was a tragedy.
Right.
And so I always cared about what happened. When I found out that he'd been released, you know, and I said, that's great. Give your husband my regards. You know, then, you know, next thing you know, we're Facebook friends, Kate and I. Next thing you know, because these things spread, they spread like a virus, right? Mm-hmm. Friendships on the internet. Then my wife becomes friends with her. And then one day I publish a short story on Kindle and Kate reads it. And then she sends me an email and she says, I've been wanting to write a book about my experiences, about how I got the Falcon and the Snowman out of prison and how I wound up marrying the Falcon after he was released from prison. Would you be interested in writing a book with me?
Wow. About this?
And my first instinct was to say, no, you need to find somebody who would do a good job. And when I bounced that off my wife, you should have seen the look on her face. She said, are you crazy? Don't tell her that. Say yes.
Yeah, it's fascinating because she read your short story and she obviously liked it and thought you were a good enough writer to actually want to attach her story to you as the writer. And meanwhile, you're like, okay, no thanks. Maybe you should find somebody better.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, it was this, like the scene and, you know, a little bit less cinematic and I'm not quite as dashing, but the scene in Rocky when they say, do you want to fight the champ? And he says, no. And then they say, wait a minute, I'm sorry. I don't know if you heard me right. We're asking you to fight him. This is your big opportunity.
Right.
And so I had that moment where I thought, I'm going to mess this up. You know, I'm not going to do a very good job of this, but I'll show them. In other words, I'm going to do the best job I can. And if they don't like it, you know, no harm, no foul, we'll part ways. And initially the book was going to be a story about Kate because she's, in addition to being a legal advocate and somebody who went up against the legal system and got a couple of guys out of prison who nobody ever thought would be released from prison, she's also a 4-5-time cancer survivor. She was doing all of these things, being a criminal advocate while she was, being given terminal diagnoses.
Oh my God.
For cancer, for ovarian cancer. Well, breast cancer, sorry.
Right. Wow.
And so that in and of itself is the story. Through the process of interviewing her, talking to her on the phone, I think her husband, Christopher Boyce, the Falcon, I think he wanted to get involved because he thought that somebody was going to be telling part of his story and he wanted to make sure that it didn't turn out badly.
Right.
It happened previously with the sequel book, The Flight of the Falcon, which was written by Robert Lindsay in the early 80s about Chris's escape from prison and recapture. He didn't participate in the writing of that book and he came off not looking well. Although it's not really possible to look well when you escape from prison and then while you're out there, you rob some banks while you're at it.
Right.
And then you get captured by the U.S. Marshals. He didn't come out of it smelling like a rose. And I think that was, you know, he understood that if somebody's going to be telling his story, he wanted to be a part of it.
Right.
So he and I started talking on the phone and we all got along. I had been friends with Kate at this point for a couple of years. And then I became friends with Chris. And the more we talked, the more we wanted to write this story. So we started.
Wow. That's like an incredible story. That's an incredible story. Like when you think about it, right? Like everybody can walk in your shoes, so to speak, on how incredible that must have been, in the sense that we all have people that we are either hero that we, you know, that are our heroes or that we're fascinated by or we find extremely interesting. And you go from a sort of internet, you know, talk radio type music show to playing the album to getting somebody to reach out. That's just surreal.
It is. And, you know, for a couple of weeks after that, when I thought about it, I was kind of in a shocked daze thinking, is this really happening? Because, you know, when you're in the situation like that, regardless of whether or not you think you can do a good job or anything like that, you're just given the opportunity to do this thing. It's the opportunity to do something extraordinary. And I'd never really had that.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that I had been living my life and pursuing the things that I enjoyed doing, the internet radio show, my own little short stories and things like that. But then suddenly this got big because, you know, for better or for worse, he was a famous person, a famous criminal,
mm-hmm.
and had a movie made about him and all that sort of thing. So even if I divorced myself from my perception of it, from my you know, watching this movie when I was a kid and being fascinated by it, I thought how the rest of the world is going to be very interested in this. And as it turned out, they were, because right around this time, the whole Edward Snowden thing exploded.
Right.
And we were in the middle of writing the book, and I had built a website, thefalconandthesnowman.com, to start a blog to try and drum up interest in the writing of the book, and hopefully the selling of the book to a major publisher. And so through this process of writing blogs and having Kate write blogs and having Chris write blogs, at the same time the Edward Snowden story explodes and people start seeking Chris out. They start thinking somebody somewhere made a connection, saying this is like, even the name Snowden, this is like the Falcon and the Snowden, you know, it's some sort of a, it's not quite the same because he wasn't selling secrets to the Soviet Union. He was telling secrets to the American public, which was way different.
Right.
And I even talked to Chris about this. I said, you know, what do you think of this guy? And he said, he's doing what I wish I had done because, you know, he regrets having gone to the Soviet Union, obviously, to, with, and there were the reasons why he sold secrets to the Soviet Union. I mean, that's a separate show in and of itself, but it was essentially in almost muted protest to some things that were happening that he discovered when he worked for a CIA contractor in Southern California called TRW.
Right.
And these are things that are discussed at length in the movie. If somebody ever wants to watch the movie, we try to recap a little bit of it in the beginning of the book to sort of give background on this. But, you know, when I wrote this book, when I got together with the two of them, I didn't want it to be political at all.
Right.
I wanted it to be, because when I discovered when I learned the story about how these guys went to prison, for some reason, when I was a young man, I assumed that I assumed that espionage was a blue collar crime and that you would be put in club fed for a crime like that. But quite the contrary, they were sent to prison, you know, in the federal prison, you know, with rapists, murderers, you know, those fun types.
Right.
And with no real prior records, I'm surprised that they survived the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I recognized that there was a real human drama there aside from the politics. I said, we need to have the story take place after these two guys get sent to prison and after Kate comes in a few years after that in an effort to seek their release from prison,
mm-hmm.
which was a process that took about 20 years.
Wow.
It was just inspiring because it touches on so many different things. There's the Snowden thing. There's the stories that became big news at the time about the psychological damage that prisoners undergo when they're put in solitary confinement for a very long time, which Christopher Boyce lived mm-hmm. in solitary confinement for about 10 years. And, you know, just, you know, the whole cancer survivor thing, it was a big drama. And I wanted to focus on those things. And I think that's what we did. I think the book is very non-political, but it is a bit of a touchy issue among readers.
Right. So you're writing this book, this drama that's based on sort of a tragedy, and then along comes the Snowden thing, which just sort of throws some gasoline on that fire, so to speak, and takes this book and brings it, you know, serendipity totally, right? Where now you're ready to publish and you've got a book that people care about. People want to, people are interested in him in that story all over again.
Right. We had an email from, CNN, and they were interviewed. They were interested in interviewing Chris to get his opinion on Edward Snowden, who had just recently fled to the Soviet Union. And a lot of people were drawing comparisons, saying that these were young men in their 20s who, for whatever reason, really upset the government, their government. And they wanted his take on it. They were drawing comparisons between Christopher Boyce and Edward Snowden, for better or for worse. And I thought, well, this is great. This is a great opportunity for us to talk about the book. And the book was mentioned. We didn't have it ready to go. We were still writing it. So I remember my wife took a full-time job. She's an artist, but she went back to a job that she had left about a year earlier to focus all her time on her art. And she said, look, I'll pay the bills, just write this book. So I was able to stop my freelance projects and all that stuff so that I could focus ten hours a day,
right,
7 days a week, and lots of late nights and wine, things like that. Food. I probably gained 30 pounds while I was doing this. And I think I may have shaved off a couple of years, but, you know, we'll find out someday. And so we finished the book very quickly. And I think that was one of the reasons why we finished it, because if we didn't have a deadline like that, we may have still been working on it to this day.
Welcome back. I'm talking with author and publishing entrepreneur Vince Fond about when the world doesn't come knocking, you have to learn to do things yourself. Tell me how, from, you know, writing this book, how did you end up in the self-publishing realm of things? How did that all come for you?
Yes, I allowed myself to, during the writing of the book, to fantasize about Simon and Schuster breaking down our door.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
Timothy Hutton.
That's the storyline, right? That's how it happens.
Right. Orion Pictures saying, oh, we want to make a sequel. We'll buy that book right now and we'll start production on it. So that, you know, all that stuff. And, you know, the reality is that none of that happened. We pitched the book. Chris and Kate got an audience with, I don't know if it was the president of Simon and Schuster or, you know, one of the main editors there. Who said that they were interested in the book, but, you know, we want to write it with our own, we want to assign our own inside author to handle this with you. So there was no room for me in that plan. And I was, if they had said, hey, Vince, you know, sorry, you're out, I would have said, well, good luck. I look forward to reading the book.
Right.
But Chris and Kate are very loyal people. And there's nothing about either of them that doesn't scream maverick. So they did the maverick thing, and they turned down Simon and Schuster for the opportunity to continue working on the book that we were writing, because one of the worries was that they were going to have somebody else that they didn't trust telling their story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, by this time, we'd become good friends, and I just wanted to tell the story truthfully and as well as possible. So we started searching for representation, agents. We went through a couple that weren't good fits. We found one, but the basic gist is we landed ourselves a New York City agent that worked for a big, big company. She pitched this book from HarperCollins all the way down the list, and all the imprints and all the big major publishers, they all reviewed the book and said, good book, but we don't know how to market it. We don't know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
I've since learned that I think that's code for something. I'm not quite sure, but I hear a lot of authors tell me the same thing. They say, you know, I sent it to an agency and they said, good book, but we don't know how to market it, which I think maybe that means that it's not about, at the time, it wasn't about sparkly vampires or, you know, 50 Shades of Grey or anything like that.
Exactly. Like, you know, in the movie industry, they are always talking about when they pitch movies, they go, it's like Deer Hunter meets Thelma and Louise, right? And that's how they can pitch it. And that's how they can market it. And that's how they can get people involved. And if you come along as a writer or a creative person in any way, and you've got something that isn't recognizable, they can't see it out there already existing, it's impossible for them to then say, well, we know how we're going to make money from this, right? Which is, again, the we don't know how to market it is code word for we don't think we can make money from this because it's not a lookalike. And I think that's the thing with original types of stories, especially, you know, when it comes to, you know, creatively told stories or stories that are done, you know, from a different perspective or anything new, the traditional world stops and goes, oh, we don't know what to do with this, right? Whether it's a band, whether it's a movie, whether it's a book, whether it's an artist, and it's an, it has to find its own life before they then go, oh, and then you become the name that they use when they're pitching the next idea that's just like it.
Exactly. And one of the, I don't know if it was a problem necessarily, but, you know, I'm that guy who likes the bands that I tell them, what's your favorite band? Marillion. Who's that? Who's your favorite singer? You know, this guy, who are these people you're talking about? And right. I was in the same mindset, and I was, I think, in a way I wasn't really seeing it from the perspective, obviously I'm not going to see it from the perspective of somebody who's saying no, because I don't want to see it that way. But, you know, I would have pitched it as, this is a sequel to The Falcon and the Snowman. And they're going to say, what's that? Nobody knows what that is. Okay. Mm. But it starred Timothy Hutton. Who? You know, yeah. Sean Penn. Oh, Sean Penn. Was he the guy that was married to Madonna? Okay. Yeah. But she's, you know, even that doesn't, there's nothing there.
Right.
You're exactly right. We couldn't really pitch it as anything. You know, I was thinking, but this is like the, you know, the book Midnight Express or Papillon. And these are books that have been written and published 35 years ago. Mm-hmm. They're not contemporary books. And so in that way, the American Sons book is not a, really a contemporary book. It's almost a throwback to those kind of prison escape stories that I read when I was a kid and loved. So therefore, it didn't really fit. Finally, at one point, our agent pitched us to an independent press in the Pacific Northwest called Sasquatch Books. At that point, I think we all three of us looked at each other and over the phone and said, I think that maybe we might be able to do something on our own. At this time, I had had some experience self-publishing shorts on Kindle. But during this time, Amazon.com got really good at allowing people to produce physical books, paperback books. Now, there's other companies who have been doing this, who had been doing this longer, but they were very expensive. I had looked into them and it was confusing what I needed to do to get a book published. Amazon Publishing was very user-friendly. And so I said, well, you know, let me just, you know, do my own little book really quick and see what it looks like. And, you know, we did a couple of test pressings. And at this point, the book had been finished. So I just decided, why don't we try to self-publish this book? Because at this point, we were getting lots and lots of hits on our website from CNN articles. And, you know, I just did I think I did a great job of just kind of building up SEO mojo on that website from the URL to, you know, if you Google search whatever happened to Christopher Boyce, it points you right to our website. Right. And right there, you know, it's the, here's the book if you want to read it. During this time, I was getting all this experience with the DIY aspect of it. My wife being sort of a visual person, we thought maybe you could make a book cover. And, you know, I know a lot of writers and editors just by doing what I do. So I hired a friend who was also an editor to edit the book because I conceded that I wouldn't be able to edit my own book. And I say my own book, but it was the three of us.
So you decide to take it down the self-published sort of Amazon road, and this was before you had decided, oh, I'm going to put my shingle out as a self-publishing company, right? You were just a author trying to publish.
Right. And essentially what happened was, it is so hard coming from having never done it before, to learn how to format the interior of a book, picking cream paper versus white paper because that looks better on the eye, all these decisions and all these things, copywriting a book, getting an ISBN, all the things that you need to do, there's a great learning curve, even if you're working with Amazon, which makes it easy. So you have to know what you're doing really to do it well. And I got to the point where, you know, I had so much experience doing that, and I was focusing on marketing the book and all that stuff. But in the meantime, I wrote something else and I published it, a little novella that was more along the lines of my Twilight Zone, Stephen King upbringing. I got to the point where I was so good at it, but I had run out of material to publish of my own.
Right.
So I started, a lot of people that, well, my wife at the time ran a gallery in this city. And so we were connected with a lot of creatives. And I would get a lot of questions from local writers asking, you know, what do I do for this? What do I do for that? And I always had answers. And so I thought maybe I could, you know, just launch a website. Maybe I'll get a couple people interested and, you know, publish, help them self-publish a book. Maybe create an imprint name that might sound cool, that somebody would want to be associated with. My idea was to sort of start this kind of an online community or a community of authors who were tied together by the same book imprint name.
Right.
And that's where this idea came from. And I didn't think really that it was going to be as successful as it was. I didn't know what was going to happen.
Right. You just did it. You know, that's the part that I think this whole story you're telling is just about, you know, that old saying, showing up, right? You know, you've just followed your passion and you've followed your interests and, you know, you said yes when you got offered some opportunities. And so here you are and you're showing up. Okay, I guess I'll put a shingle out. I'll be a self-publishing company and see where it goes, right? It's a very interesting story, especially for this day and time where people are having to reinvent themselves and figure out ways to earn different forms of income, you know, trying to do things either remotely or, you know, freelance wise and wearing multiple hats. And so Glass Spider Publishing is born. So tell me about the name. How did you decide on that name?
Well, and again, I swear this all leads back to 1985. Because like I told you, in 1985, I saw The Falcon and the Snowman. I was a big fan of David Bowie. Fast forward to 2013, when I'm working on the book with Chris and Kate. David Bowie released a new album, First in 10 Years. I loved it. It became the soundtrack to my life as I worked on the book. And as my wife opened an art gallery at the same time.
Wow.
This was after she quit the job that she took to help finance the writing of the book, right? So.
Right.
And so this one album the next day for the fans became the soundtrack to my life, to our life. In December of 2015 was when I was planning. In January, I'm going to roll out this business name or this business, which I had at the time I called it. I just formed a website called getmystorypublished.com, which is don't even look for it because it's gone now. But I thought, you know, I need a good, like an imprint name. You can't say Get My Story. Who's going to want to publish their book under Get My Story Published Books? It sounds like, you know.
Yeah, it's self.
Cheesy.
You might as well just say self-published book.
Right, exactly. And the David Bowie fans know what's coming. But for everybody else who doesn't remember, in January of 2016 was when we decided was the launch date for the company. And I had settled on like the last week of January or something, long enough time for me to get my act together. And then David Bowie died in the beginning of January, and he had just released an album. His death was the first celebrity death that really hurt. I have been, you know, a fan of many artists and musicians and actors who died, but it didn't really shake me this way.
Right.
Because I had what I felt was a connection all the way back to the beginning. And, you know, the reason that I started this company was because of my experience writing the book, you know, the book to which he is somewhat tied because he had a song in The Falcon and the Snowman, an iconic song called This Is Not America. Anyway, so I wanted to pay tribute to his passing. And I thought, well, I'm not going to call it David Bowie Books because I'm not going to get sued. I wasn't going to call it Let's Dance Books because that would be too obvious. Believe it or not, Black Star Books was taken, Black Star being the name of his last album.
Right.
And so I really started almost like a grab bag of names. And the one that really stuck out was, well, he had a song from a 1987 album, and the song was called Glass Spider. Mm-hmm. And in that song, which is one of his more obscure songs and not from his greatest era, he begins the song by telling a story. He's speaking, telling a story. Once upon a time, you know, this, and it, you know, goes into a song. And I thought that's perfect. Mm-hmm. And it has kind of had an ambiguous, there's nothing, you know, intended by the name. It's sort of almost like an abstract name that somebody who knows David Bowie will understand, and somebody who doesn't might just think it's kind of weird or cool.
Right.
Yeah. And so we called it that. And that's where the name came from. And I found it to be kind of a blessing because a lot of people have reached out and they've said, that name was really struck me because it was really interesting. Where did the name come from? And most of them don't know where it came from. And so, yeah, that's that. I mean, and I'm proud to have that name in a manner that I feel it kind of keeps me a little bit centered. It keeps me from being too money driven because of the state of mind that I was in when I named the company. Reminded me of what I was doing it for, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, that's a very interesting. And again, it's just all so woven together. And so when you say it's been a blessing, there's a certain energy behind it where there's a meaning to it. And as you say, you know, the song starts with him starting to tell a story. It's just, yeah. I mean, it even goes full circle back to your guitar days, right? Which you said ruined your life.
Exactly. And, you know, what's funny is recently I picked it up. I've never really put it away. It's always been in the corner. And I picked it up and I thought, for the first time since I started playing guitar, I thought, what are the chords to This Is Not America by David Bowie? And they were so simple. They were some of my favorite chords. So I started playing it.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, God, why? How come I didn't do this a long time ago? This is a great song. I could do my own version, but I didn't want to, you know, I'm not going to share it with anybody because that would be, because it would be wrong.
Right.
Anyway. It's a trip because it does take me all the way back.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a fascinating story. So now, you know, Glass Spider Publishing, you have how many books under your sort of imprint?
The number is unofficially 75.
Wow. In five years?
In 5 years, yeah.
Wow. That's incredible. That's
which is, you know, the whole five-year thing, too. We just celebrated our five-year anniversary. And again, the David Bowie fans will know there's a great David Bowie song called 5 Years. And I've been singing it all year, although, you know, that song originally was about, you know, the impending end of the world in 5 years. but in this case, and then, of course, 2020 happened. And I thought, I've cursed the world by coming up on a 5-year anniversary of this company. I've cursed it because I've made it happen. And of course, that all leads back to Rod Serling.
Right. Right. Love it.
Welcome back. I'm talking with author and publishing entrepreneur Vince Fond about the wisdom and advice he would give to his younger self and the first question he asks every writer wanting to publish their very first book.
So if you were to go back after this journey you've been on, and you were to go back to your unpublished writer, short story, want to be published self, you know, because there's going to be a lot of people out there that listen to this that are, you know, want to be one day published writers. What would you tell yourself, or what would be some advice you'd give yourself?
Well, the first thing that I usually ask people when I'm talking to them, clients, is why are you writing? Hmm. What do you want to do with it? If you want to become a big star, you might be better off playing the lottery or something like that. Because writing, being a success in writing, can be defined in many different ways. I was just happy to have people reading the book. I didn't care, you know, if I, you know, how much of a royalty I was earning or anything like that. It's very exciting to have a complete stranger tell you, I read this book in one day, mm-hmm. you know, and it was, you know, blew my mind, whatever. Or just, you know, to say good story, you know, a pat on the head. But a lot of people, there are a lot of people who go into it because they want, they think, because they see the Stephanie Meyers of the world, she's self-published. And I think she's the 50 Shades, she's the 50 Shades of Grey author.
Right.
They see the Stephanie Meyers of the world who self-published a book and suddenly it becomes a phenomenon. And they think, well, that's easy. I mean, I can do that. But anybody can write a book, and you don't have to be a great writer to write a book. But not everybody, not even Stephanie Meyer, knows how to catch lightning in a bottle.
Right.
And so you have to think. And I always use American Sons as a cautionary tale when I tell people, you know, I wrote a book with a famous person, because again, nobody knows who he is, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody under 50. I wrote a book with a famous person, and we had CNN. They were on CNN. We were covered on CNN 2-3 times. Geraldo Rivera wanted to call and have us on, have Chris on, probably to scream at him for something.
Yeah.
And we didn't do that, obviously. But you know, even if you write a book with a famous person, even if you are a famous person, that doesn't mean that the book company is going to be interested in publishing you. It doesn't mean that it's a bad book or it's a bad idea. It all has to do with what's happening at the time, what time of day they open your email, you know, or what they had for lunch. And the ones that I really enjoy working with the most are the people who just want, they write because they want to, because they're enjoying themselves. And because they want to be able to share it with other people. You know, they've got family members who have read their book and said, you should publish this and share this with other people, sell a couple hundred copies. And that's the majority of people that I work with. That's them. Right. And that's the first question I ask is, what do you want to do with this? If you want to be rich, I don't know if I can help you. If you want to just get this out there, but you want to do a good job, because you, the one thing I tell authors all the time is that you cannot edit your own work. Mm-hmm. You are not the best judge of whether or not your book is good, and that there's a lot more to getting people to read your book than putting it up. If you publish it, they will not come. You have to go to them with your book. The ones who get the most out of this experience of working with Glass Spider Publishing, self-publishing a book with our help, are those who understand that they are their best advocates, that nobody else, even if they hired a publicist, we don't do publicity because publicity is super expensive. And in a lot of ways, you have to have a lot of connections for things like that. But I have sent authors to publicists, and they've spent a lot of money, but it's nothing that they can't do themselves if they're willing to do it. And you just really have to be promoting your own book for the rest of your life. Another thing I always tell authors is, this book that you're writing is not the commodity. You are the commodity. People are going to be interested in you in this book if you have more than one book. Nobody likes to read a one-trick pony. Nobody's interested in getting into a band that has only one album, because if they fall in love, they don't have anywhere else to go.
Right. Right. That's a good point. Yeah.
And if you have a great big long bibliography of books, if you have a book series, 7 or 8 books, you can make one of them free on Amazon, the Kindle, make it free. So people will read it and they'll get hooked and they'll buy the other 7, mm-hmm. that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fascinating. Like, there's so many different ways to go about doing it now because of the ability to be self-published, because of the ability to be able to print on demand and be on Amazon or Kindle and et cetera. It's so much different than it was when it was all just about getting a publisher to publish you, right?
Oh, yeah. You couldn't be a writer unless somebody told you that you could be a writer, but now you can be a writer if you say so. And I've realized this, another thing that I'm coming to realize about myself through this is that I've always been jazzed. I think it's a real gas, as the kids say, when people take matters into their own hands and stop waiting for permission to do things, to be a writer, you know, to do anything, to start, I don't know, yeah. to start camping or, you know, to start skydiving, whatever. If you want to do something, you just have to learn how to do it. And yeah, then do it. I believe that the book industry today is operating under, like, you know, 19th century methodologies or 19th century practices. Mm-hmm. They had a hard time understanding and embracing ebooks when they first came out.
Right.
And likewise, there is, you know, they have to survive, obviously. And, but, you know, nowadays it's entirely possible for a self-published author to go up against an author who's been published by Random House and get a lot more reviews. It's the democratization of publishing. And I know a lot of people have problems with Amazon, don't want to shop through Amazon. There are other options that we work with also. There's an alternative to Amazon publishing called Ingram Spark. They're a little harder to work with. They're not as user-friendly, but there are other options. But you know, the point is that you really need to use the internet to your benefit. There's more value in having your book on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com than there is in having your book on a shelf in Barnes & Noble, because how many people are really going to see that?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I had somebody once tell me, like, oh, the way I always decide if I want to buy a book is I thumb through it and I look at it in the bookstore and stuff. And I thought, well, that's not happening that much anymore, right? Especially with the pandemic, you're not in a bookstore thumbing through a book. So people are making decisions online, purchasing books online, and that's a completely different process. So everything is changing. And so, yes. You know, like, that's, you know, the whole online world is a great place for us to wrap up, because you have a lot of valuable resources online at glassspiderpublishing.com, where you kind of, you don't give it away for free, but you sort of offer up a lot of the sort of, you know, ways of approaching self-publishing and the ways of marketing and figuring out how, if you are a writer, how you want to get your book out into the world. You're sort of offering that as a service, which I think is something that's, again, so much different than the traditional publishing way, where if you didn't get your foot in the door, you didn't know how it was done. And I think that that's the amazing thing about the internet, is you can learn how a lot of this stuff works through people like yourself who are offering people sort of, you know, hey, take what you need, right? Here's a bit of information. If you need our help with this, there's that. If you need our help doing something more, we can do more. But it's not a, like, you know, all or nothing kind of process. At least that's how it seems to me when I visit your website.
Right, it is. And, you know, being a writer, it's very important to me for that authors keep the rights to their books. If you sign a publishing contract with a major publisher, with a publishing company that's not a hybrid publishing company, you're giving away the publication rights to your book, and they're going to hold it for 7 years at minimum, or standard 7 years. We got into a deal like that with American Sons was eventually picked up. The ebook was picked up by a European independent publisher who wanted to represent the book, and also by an audiobook company who did a really good job creating an audiobook. But the ebook company was one that we went from earning, you know, quite a bit of money to earning very little money, because they take 90% of the retail, or they take 90% of the royalties, mm-hmm. in exchange for being on their imprint. And that's not all that valuable, especially when it comes to ebooks. So
right.
Fortunately for us, the company went under and we got the rights to the book back, and I'm never going to give it away again.
Right.
Unless somebody like Random House wanted the book, and then I'd have to reexamine my beliefs or something, or I'd have to hire a really good lawyer and have them look at a contract. But that said, I believe that in order to help people, even in order to bring business in, you have to be willing to give away information. Obviously, you can't just hide it behind a paywall.
Yeah.
And say, I can tell you how to do this, but you got to pay me $50 or whatever. I even went so far as to have a phone number on the website now. And I invite people to say, call me, even if you're not interested, if you have just questions. Mm-hmm. And I've gotten a lot of calls from people who I ended up not working with, because, you know, they can't afford the services, or, you know, I totally understand that. I wouldn't be able to afford me, I don't think. Which is another reason why I do what I do, is because I had to learn how to do it myself.
Right.
And I have a phone number there, and I get calls all the time from people asking, you know, what do you think I should do with this? What do you think I should do with that? And I found that I really enjoy talking about this. I've discovered, after doing it for several years, sort of as, you know, I've been on a tightrope, and I've been just concentrating on not falling over. And I was finally able to look up and look around and say, okay, I'm in a place now where where everything's going well, and I'm enjoying this. Mm-hmm. This is something that, I mean, there've been a couple of times when I've thought maybe I should just, you know, focus on my own writing and not do this. But then I always talk to somebody who really needs help, who has a really good book that I want to help.
Right. Yeah.
And that keeps me in. And that's it, kind of, like I said, lately I've realized that I, on a daily basis, I do what I did in high school. I sometimes even listen to the same music that I was listening to at the time, because of course we had the boombox playing in the classroom when this was going on.
Yeah.
And I find myself in that same place, and I think, this is what I really enjoy doing, and I'm doing it.
Well, that's, yeah, it's incredible. It's a great story. It's a great story from, you know, how you got into it, how you started to write the book, how, you know, everything about it's very serendipitous. So with that, I am going to direct people that are interested in learning more about yourself or interested in looking at some of your other books to go to glassspiderpublishing.com. That's GLASS. SSPIDERPUBLISHING.com, glassspiderpublishing.com, and check out everything that you offer, your blog, etc. And if they want to reach out, there's the phone number they can reach out, but they can get in touch and they can learn everything about self-publishing. Vince, thank you so much for your time today. I've really enjoyed listening to your story. I find it very fascinating, and I really appreciate the detail you gave me.
Yeah, thanks, Brian, for having me. It's just a pleasure talking to you, and bye.
All right.
Well, that's another episode of Listen In. Thanks for being. Please subscribe, leave comments, or head on over to our website at listeninpod.com. That's listen with two N's, pod.com, where you'll find episode notes, links to anything that we talked about in this episode, and you can connect with us about being a guest on Listen In.